This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. Their highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations, and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking around team performance with Tom Hurst. So what I wanted to do in the episode is really examine human performance, some of the fundamental components of performance, models of performance, and how we train versus how we perform. We're also going to speak to the importance of psychological safety and also the interplay between performance standards and behavior. So in this episode, we're going to speak to performance as a conduit to concept of culture, really. And just what I'd like you to do within the episode is just notice some of the crucial conversations that me and Tom have around the concept of culture being really a fundamental enabler for performance. So to do this, I have Tom Hurst with me. Tom is the medical director of London's Air Ambulance. He's also a consultant in intensive care medicine at King's College Hospital, London. He's also a consultant in pre-hospital emergency care at London HEMS, Barts Health. And Tom's practice covers a wide range of general critical care, as well as neurosciences, cardiovascular, major trauma, and ECMO. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thank you very much, Owen. It's great to be here.
Tom, I just wondered if we could just start by getting you to speak to your background and indeed what drew you to work for London's Air Ambulance, both as a flight doctor and as the medical director.
Oh, so I've had a long-standing interest in sort of critical care, resuscitation, trauma, those sorts of areas. And, I trained in anaesthesia and intensive care medicine. That's my kind of base hospital specialty, but took various opportunities to try and get involved in sort of trauma care and pre-hospital care and those sorts of areas. And back in 2008, when I was a registrar, I came to London HEMS, as it was then, for 6 months as a sort of full-time flight doctor. And back then, it seems bizarre to say this, it was the only place in the UK you could come and work as a doctor in pre-hospital care. In terms of, when I say work in pre-hospital care, I mean be paid, be salaried, be in a, you know, in a full-time role with clinical supervision, consultants, all of that sort of stuff around you. Everything else, you know, I've been involved tangentially in some other schemes, was, you know, either genuine volunteer effort, which, you know, which is amazing, or they were other sort of air ambulances with ad hoc kind of doctor involvement. So London HEMS back then was where you came if you wanted in the UK to have sort of proper training in pre-hospital care. So I was, you know, that was an amazing experience for me. And like many people who've been through the service, pretty profound kind of career and life event for me. I went back up north and finished my training at the end of that, qualified as a consultant in anaesthesia and intensive care medicine. But I'd never really left HEMS spiritually, I think. And back in 2010, a consultant job came up at King's to do intensive care and major trauma. So again, you know, my kind of major passions in hospital. I moved back down to London and took that job, and I'd kind of been continuing my involvement, kept it going ever since there. And I've been involved with London's Air Ambulance in various roles since then. And I was absolutely honoured to be appointed their medical director in January 2020. I mean, astute listeners will note that's just before the pandemic hit us, but nonetheless, that's when I started.
So the concept of high performing teams and indeed performance within London's air ambulance it's been a fundamental concept since you and I started in 2009 in London's air ambulance, and it was certainly a concept, a central theme really. And I believe you've been doing some work in the background looking at human performance and indeed a human performance program. Could you maybe speak to what a human performance program is and indeed why you've chosen to adopt one?
Yeah, sure. So I think, two caveats. First, as you say, this is something that various people, well before me have been interested in. We've often called it CRM or human factors, related terms, but, looking at the non-technical side. And I'm not an expert in this, but I've been fascinated by how other industries, approach it, how sports approaches it. And I think a human performance program is basically a systematic way of looking at how we can help ensure that our teams can deliver their very best for patients, that they can perform under pressure, when they really have to. Performance programs, I think, can be very broad, and different industries and different programs focus on different things. What we've been doing, we're at very, early stage with this, but we're starting to look at some kind of almost physiological basics, particularly kind of fatigue. We're doing some work, looking at kind of work-based factors, how much non-critical work we expect people to do when they're on shift in a critical role, how much, of the kind of monthly routine of checking equipment should fall to a duty team who are actually supposed to be primed and ready to respond to an emergency. And we're starting to do some more kind of psychological work. We've got a clinical psychologist who's been involved with some staff support work and who's starting to sort of help formulate some ideas about how we can support performance.
So looking at as sort of teams rotate, and there is quite a high cadence of rotation amongst the teams, it's rare to sort of work with the same paramedic and the same doctor on any given day. But could you maybe speak to sort of because potential arises within everyone, and every colleague up at London's Air Ambulance has got a different set of potential and a set of skills. Could you maybe speak to how you channel, or indeed how we channel potential, and indeed manage interferences, both sort of internal and external?
Yeah, so there's this idea in the performance world that performance is your potential minus the interferences, and you can very crudely split those interferences into sort of internal and external. So as we've discussed, we need to kind of reduce some of the external factors that negatively impact on performance. Be that fatigue, be it that the kit is not well designed, be it that the routine of the day is detracting from your ability to perform. And we also need to help people manage some of those internal processes, whether that be, concentration or negative self-talk or, how they perform under pressure. So that's one sort of very simplistic way of thinking about sort of potential and performance. As an aside, I think there's probably something missing from the equation, which is positive impacts. I've definitely seen people who can positively impact on someone else's to the performance to the point where the performance is better than they knew it was possible for them. So it's not strictly better than their potential, but it's better than they knew it could be. And I think that's also a really positive take on kind of the idea of human performance. How can we help people, be it colleagues we work with, colleagues we meet on scene, to be even better than they knew they could be?
So Tom, on any given day in London's Air Ambulance, what are some of the fundamental attributes that you need from a team or any team, any paramedic doctor team?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been this is probably not an exhaustive list, but when I've been thinking about this, I think the things that come to mind are we need consistent high performance. I mean, in any safety critical industry, emergency healthcare is clearly one. It's not good enough to be great on one day and subpar on another day. So performance has to be consistently good. We need people to be good. They need sound decision making and judgment. Okay, so yes, there's technical procedures that have to be mastered. There's knowledge that has to be understood and accessed under pressure, but decision making and judgment are crucially important. I think our teams need to be realistically confident. And maybe 20 years ago in healthcare, people were the problem was stopping, putting people back a little bit and stopping people being overconfident. I think we need to recognize actually some people do need building up a little bit, and they do need to know they are well trained, well selected, and able to do the job, and they should feel realistically confident in their ability to go out there and deal with what's put in front of them. They have to be resilient. They have to be stress tolerant. The jobs we go to, they are some of the sickest patients on any given day in London, and they're some of the most challenging and confronting scenes of major trauma, often in public places with hundreds of onlookers. So people have to be able to be resilient to that and pick themselves up after a difficult job and move on to the next one. And there's this kind of duality where they need to be independent and good at team working. So they've got to be able to kind of stand on their own two feet, and know their own mind about things, but also work really well as part of the team, listen to other people, bring people with them. And their communication has to be, excellent across a range of situations. And again, it's not just being able to do a kind of command and control sort of shouty communication. It's also the empathic stuff. It's the empowering the rest of the team, so across a wide range of differing communication challenges, their communication has to be up to the job.
Tom, could you just unpack how important culture is? A culture of performing, but not even just a culture of performing, just the culture per se.
Sure. So that's a quick one. So culture is huge. It's a huge and complex topic. Lots of people have really strong views on it. I'm going to try and steer clear of starting a war about specific definitions of culture. I think we can say, most people would say, culture emerges from all of the actions, all of the conversations, and all of the beliefs of all of the people who make up your service or your team or whatever unit of culture you're looking at. And culture is what really goes on. So it's not what's written down or what, values or whatever you have up on the wall. And I think if you can agree on those two things, it's emergent from a whole load of inputs, some of which are really obvious and some of which are very like below the waterline. And it is about what is really happening, not what people would like to happen or perceive should be happening. So if an organization has a culture where people are supposed to do something a certain way and they routinely don't, then that tells you something about the culture. Given how broad the definition is there, you can see there's many components that make up an organization's culture. And I think it's self-evident culture is a major driver of performance. If the culture is, lacking in the attention we give selecting the right people to join the team, if we don't really follow through in the sense the way our training connects with how we actually do the work, if we don't have a culture of, careful, meticulous preparation when we have, when that time is given to us, i.e., before a mission and we've got that quiet time to check kit and be ready, then we're not going to perform at our best. All of those elements come together. So that I think is how culture impacts performance in a very, very brief nutshell.
That's fantastic, Tom. And the late great Peter Drucker said, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." And like you said, you feel the culture and sort of interact with the culture, both verbally and non-verbally, way before you sort of interact with the strategy or indeed anything else. And again, like you said, there is an intentionality around culture, almost like a daily intentionality, because it's one of these aspects which needs to be maintained over time. Could you speak to the interplay? You've already spoken to this sort of this dance almost, and the art of technical and non-technical skills, and knowing when to come in with the skill, but also knowing when to function as a team and indeed as an individual. Could you maybe speak to some key takeaways from this around performance?
So the interplay, I mean, interplay is a good phrase here, isn't it? So I one of the things I think is really important is you need strong technical skills to perform well under pressure. And you obviously also need really strong non-technical skills, and we know that kind of human factors informed approaches to safety and training and excellence and stuff are really, really powerful and definitely a part of what we do. And they're a part of both the kind of high performance end, elite, if you like, and I think they're an important part of kind of baseline safety, the kind of lowest acceptable, level to which you're going to fall. As well. So I think, the sort of non-technical stuff has a role in both of those domains. I think it's a mistake to think that non-technical skills can make up for inadequate technical skills. And I think that, we can talk a lot about, bandwidth and psychological techniques to help people improve their bandwidth, having the metacognition to recognize they're becoming overloaded, offloading, delegating, da da da. But actually, if what's taking up their bandwidth is they know they've got to put a subclavian line in, and they're weak at putting subclavian lines in, and they haven't put one in for months, and they haven't practiced, then The solution to that is to have practiced, right? The solution is a strong technical skill, not hours of non-technical ruminating. So I think non-technical stuff is hugely important. I'm really, really invested in it. But I think we have to be a bit brave here and say, in healthcare, are we using non-technical skills or human factors as a something that solves every single problem? And rather than saying, well, we have to be honest and say, this team didn't have the technical skills to handle a patient this sick. They should have, resorted to more basic care. They should have called more senior support. Yes, we can help them with some non-technical skills, but let's be honest about the technical skill deficit as well. Does that answer your question?
No, it does. It absolutely does. And I think there is a real adage to almost breaking these skills down into sort of these into micro skills, but having almost motoric subconscious patterns of not necessarily just recognition, but being able to fall back on those robust technical skills so that actually they are subconscious. So you can start to, as you said, look, use metacognition around how you're coming across that dance and that active listening piece, because you like you said, you've ingrained these technical skills into deep and burned them almost deeply into your subconscious. So I'm going to ask you around where psychological safety comes in to high performance.
So I mean, let's start with the definition. So one way of looking at it is psychological safety is the degree to which people feel able to take interpersonal risk. Well, what's interpersonal risk? It's saying, I don't know, I made a mistake, I disagree, and it's been shown to really strongly underperform team performance, like across a range of industries. Google did a massive bit of work across all of their teams. Psychological safety came out as an absolutely fundamental underpinning of that. We know it's crucial and sometimes lacking in healthcare. And if we accept healthcare is complex, it's messy, there's a lot of stuff going on that is not, where the relationships are not clear and not cause and effect is not obvious, things are not linear, and it's adaptive, it's always changing, there are always new demands externally, new events. So it's obvious we can't use, for most stuff, a command and control approach in healthcare. So we've got to learn, individuals have got to learn, teams have got to learn, and systems have got to learn. So if you accept all of that, then it seems crystal clear to me that you can't learn if people are afraid. If people are fearful to say, to be honest about the work they're doing and say, oh, you know what, Tom, that's not how it happens at 4 o'clock in the morning when we're trying to do X, Y, and Z, on shift. If they can't be honest about the work they do, then as leaders of those systems, we don't know what the real work is. And then, we're more likely to have a safety problem. And if people can't be open and honest about stuff, they can't learn, we can't help them. And therefore, they as individuals and the whole system can't improve. So psychological safety is, I think, is crucial for high performance. It's not just crucial for baseline safety. It's crucial to get people working at a really high level, for all of us in the system to be able to say, I might be the medical director, but you know what? I'm not great at video laryngoscopy. It wasn't a tool when I was, spending my life in an operating theatre. I need to get better at that. I need someone to show me some tips and tricks, and I need to be brave enough to say, I'm going to use it the next case that I'm intubating with someone. And I may look like, I may not look like a highly experienced pre-hospital care consultant using this piece of equipment, because it isn't, a piece of equipment that is super intuitive to me. So I think that's how psychological safety links both to kind of patient safety and the sort of baseline, but also to sort of excellence and to elite performance.
I really agree with that, actually. And one of the, just looking back at my career, I think my time at London's Air Ambulance almost galvanized and really formed and shaped a lot of my practice. And you're right, some of the fundamental components of that was just transparency and vulnerability in D&D, saying, yeah, we this was maybe suboptimal. We maybe didn't do the best here, but we can go away, reflect, and we can train and practice. Mm-hmm. But that sense of transparency, that sense of belonging, actually, and that sense of meta team, also those 10 years really galvanized me as an individual, and have kind of I carried a lot of that with me through to my own critical care practice and rested on a lot of that sort of received wisdom. But could I get you to speak to, so, this sense of meta team and how important it is to have a sense of belonging within a team?
Yeah, so I mean, linking back to psychological safety, one of the definitions of psychological safety is it's an environment we talked about safe taking interpersonal risk, safe for taking interpersonal risk, that arises from a sense of belonging and respect. And I used to think the respect bit was the most important bit, you know, that people treating each other respectfully was what drove that sense of psychological safety. But I actually think that belonging might be kind of even more important. And there's a great book by a guy called Owen Easton called Belonging. And it talks about, you know, links back to kind of human evolution and how we have evolved to need to belong. You know, we've evolved to need to belong to small, effective groups that can help each other thrive and survive. And you know, there's evidence from, you know, conflict and war that when people feel a strong sense of identity in those conflicts, the group, they feel belonging, they make a contribution to, you know, the survival of their group, that actually, interestingly, mental illness and suicide declined dramatically during those times. Now, I'm not suggesting that war is a good thing, and clearly the mental health impact of conflicts, particularly on combatants and civilians, is truly dreadful. So I'm not suggesting that war is a good thing. But I think it tells us a bit about human nature, that people have this really strong drive to feel they belong to a team or a group, and that they have an essential role to play, and that they belong and they're valued. And so if our processes for dealing with patient safety or quality or learning make people feel that their sense of belonging is under threat, that they're not good enough to belong, you know, that sort of thing, then that can cause real damage. You know, people can feel very vulnerable. And, you know, we know that psychological pain is processed in the brain in the same centers that process physical pain. So this isn't soft, fluffy stuff. This is real neurobiological processes where, you know, we have evolved to perceive a threat to being safely accepted within a group as a threat to our survival, because 50,000 years ago, it was a threat to our survival. So we have to be really mindful of this. We have to build a strong sense of belonging, to these teams.
One of the concepts I really was sort of etched into me, burned into my brain actually, when we certainly for sign off was, you know, just really knowing the SOPs, so the standard operating procedures inside out. And in essence, standard operating procedures are almost expectations, a set of expectations that actually this will happen when you are on scene. Irrespective of the weather conditions, irrespective of the patient. Now, standard operating procedures don't always apply because the patients that London's air ambulance aren't always standard. There's definitely deviation there. But I guess what I'm getting at is, could you maybe speak to, because there's never really an SOP for performance, for team performance. It's always kind of hidden in or maybe explicitly stated within the clinical care. Could you maybe speak to sort of your thoughts on a sort of team performance SOP?
Yeah, okay. Lots to unpack on in there. Really great thread. So you're right. So SOPs help with performance because they give us a common standard. So they set expectations. They allow people to train to that standard and work together to that standard. So it makes it more likely that they will succeed together because the expectations are clear. So then you get an upward spiral of performance. People are going, you know, they're going out, they feel they've been trained to do a job. You as the paramedic are expecting me as the doctor to do a certain thing, to use a certain set of drugs in a certain way, and I do. And I'm expecting you as a paramedic to do certain things, and you do. And therefore we come back from that with A, hopefully the patient's safe and getting high quality care, but also us as a team feeling that we are on the same page, that we belong together on, you know, on that aircraft, on that car. So I think, you know, that it SOPs help support that kind of a culture of consistency, and one where we can expect our colleagues to be dependable and reasonably predictable, and that enhances team efficacy. You're absolutely right. We don't really define in an SOP kind of what exactly non-technical skills or communication behaviors or whatever we want to see on scene. And perhaps we should. I mean, I think it's, you know, thinking about the question, it's a good question. You know, it's a good challenge. I think we use other methods for transmitting that more implicit knowledge. You know, people do an observer shift before they start being in practice, so hopefully they see what it's supposed to look like. We run, you know, on our training courses, we demonstrate first how we expect things to look, as well as coaching people through some of those trickier, more implicit things. And as you know, we use a lot of debrief both in the training period and post sign off to sort of really fill out some of the more tacit knowledge that are around, you know, behaviors and performance.
Tom, could you speak to the difference, or indeed the differentiation, between perfectionism or a mindset of perfectionism versus a mindset of excellence?
Yeah. So I think excellence is about doing the best with the resources you have available, including all the non-glorious bits, you know, like the documentation. And I think it's about coming away from every job with something you've learned from the case, something that you are committed to doing better next time, or building on, or improving, or changing in the system around you, or whatever it is. But still being able to draw some contentedness or some contentment from your work. I think, and I suppose also stepping back a minute, I think it's also excellence culturally is about an environment where you and the people around you want things to be better tomorrow than they are today, whether that's through research, through quality improvement, through education, that, you know, there is a sort of a hunger or a kind of strong desire to make things better, you know, not just today, but tomorrow. I think those are some of the elements of excellence, but I think it's really hard to pin it down. Perfectionism, I think, is kind of believing there's an absolute standard that if you can reach every single time, then no one will ever be able to criticize you. Then you know, you're kind of somehow safe, you're invulnerable, you've reached that standard, end of discussion. And I think perfectionism is based in sort of fear and shame, and that sense that if you weren't perfect, you might not belong and you might be rejected. And there are people who would say perfectionism is addictive and it's destructive. And again, some of the most profound work I've read about this is from an author, Brené Brown, you know, who writes very powerfully about, you know, shame and the sort of the damage shame does to people. And yeah, that concept of perfectionism being addictive and destructive comes from her work.
So as we start to come into land, Tom, on the conversation, could you maybe speak to, this is a journey of exploration for all of us, indeed, myself just looking around my biases. And I think you were saying before around how, you know, you grow through this period of just starting to deconstruct your thought processes with other people, and then actually your biases can become apparent to yourself and to others. But could you maybe speak to hindsight bias, and where you sort of see this play out in practice, or indeed in debrief?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people don't get this. I don't think it's always fully grasped. I certainly didn't. You know, you sort of hear the term, you think you've understood it. Yeah. Okay. So the thing that made this clearest to me is a simple experiment, which is, you know, a mental experiment. If you were to write down a simple case study where a healthcare professional makes an error, and you keep the error the same, but you write three different endings to that story, one where nothing happens, none where the patient has, you know, minor harm, and one where they're severely harmed. And you give those to people at random, you know, the healthcare professionals, and ask them to comment on it. And what you see is the more severe the harm is, the more people believe the practitioner should have been able to foresee what would have happened. You know, they should have been able to catch their error, know that that was that they were making an error, and so on, even though the error is actually the same. Okay, so in other words, it's really hard to disconnect our analysis of a case and our analysis of our own decision making, or another clinician's decision making in particular, from the outcome. So, you know, we can see a situation where, you know, there's a drug prescribing error, and, you know, patient's allergic to a drug and they're prescribed the drug, but actually there comes to no harm, and everyone goes, oh, never mind, you know, minor error. If the patient dies of anaphylaxis, clearly, we, you know, everyone is very concerned about that. We've got a significant problem. And most of us would look at that as if to say, well, that was obviously going to happen. If you give a patient a drug that they're allergic to, then you're going to cause severe harm. How did you not see that happening? So I think really understanding hindsight bias is important if we're going to be involved in debriefing and sort of case analysis. So we have to exercise a lot of self-discipline. I think we have to, you know, I think it's really important that we assume our colleagues are positively intended. Everyone comes to work wanting to do a good job, wanting to help patients, wanting to be, you know, good clinicians, the best they can be. So then we have to ask ourselves, how would the decision have made sense to them? And then we often start to realize, well, they didn't have all the information we have now. You know, often when we write a set of case notes, we don't write, when I arrived, I knew this. 5 minutes in, I knew this. 10 minutes, you know, often we're writing with hindsight and we don't fully reconstruct it in that way. And when you debrief it in a little bit more detail, the point at which they were making the decision is not the point where they had all the information they had by the end of the case. So you have to bear that in mind. And then you have to remember, they were the ones actually making the decision, and they were making it in real time at a real incident with all the other real pressures that were going on for them. And however excellent and however high performing people are, it is different looking at a case in the cold light of day than being the one stood there making the decision. So I think, and that's one of the things I really try to incorporate into the way we do D&D, is to make sure we are being respectful of the people who are involved, of their positive intention, of their genuine desire to get it right, and of the difficulty we all have in reconstructing stuff once the outcome is known, once the roulette wheel has stopped spinning, so to speak. And that doesn't mean that we can't say, I think you got that wrong. You know, you went off SOP, and the consequences that followed, you know, probably relate in most part to that decision. And that's why we have that SOP. Let's understand why it made sense for you to go off SOP. So this isn't about not having honest conversations, not saying to people that particular action fell below the standards we expect in this service. But it's about saying that that's about that action and that behavior, not about you as an individual. And it's about approaching it with a sense of curiosity and saying, how did it make sense for you? Because actually we can learn important things about the system there. You know, we can learn that, you know, we had a case where, you know, a surgical airway was done. It was done correctly, but it could probably have been avoided if a hyperangulated blade had been used at video laryngoscopy. But actually the place where we put the VL blade is not totally intuitive. And we discussed moving it. And, you know, we looked at it from a system point of view and what we could learn from it and how that decision made sense for the team at the time, not from a kind of punitive, well, it was obvious that you could have had another go with a different device. You know, the failure in inverted commas rests with the practitioner. So that's how I think hindsight bias plays into how I try and think about cases and get people to reflect and learn from them.
And it's excellent that, as you said there, Tom, that you come to cases around a table. So for death and disability, for this sort of call debrief, so to speak, with a sense of curiosity. And like you said, it's actually letting the team tell the narrative, the sequential and chronological narrative, but also tell it in a way whereby you put yourself there, the information is coming at that time and at that pace, because as you said, having the outcome notes or indeed having the follow-up notes is helpful, but it's not necessarily, as you said, what the team were dealing with. So it's really good to have that front of mind to let the team process.
And actually, if you approach it with curiosity and you let them tell the story, sometimes you will learn that actually the SOP is wrong, you know, or that the SOP is might have been right one day, but it isn't right anymore, that, you know, that things have changed, you know. And if you listen to people talk about the work they're really doing with curiosity and openness, it doesn't stop you saying, actually, I think you got that wrong, or I think that, you know, the SOP is what you should have been following here. But it gives you the opportunity to go, oh, yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's not a helpful instruction in the SOP, or the way we've taught you that has clearly been confusing and has clearly made it harder for you to make the right decision in the moment. We need to rethink how we teach that on the HEMS training course, or, you know, in sign-off month. So I think it is really important to have that openness to, yes, the system is pretty good. It's pretty robust. We inculcate people in it in a very, as you say, pretty high tempo way. We're pretty good at training a sort of throughput of people. But we're not perfect. And, you know, there will be times where if we listen carefully, we can make the system better based on, you know, what people are telling us about the work as it's really done.
And I think just before we come into land and just talk about this fundamental component of culture, it's really interesting moving into a place where you're starting to govern and indeed break down decisions when there was maybe a consultant phone call and what were the decisions made there, but also what was the information, what was the clarity and conciseness of information passed to the consultant phone call? Was it formulaic? So was there a clear sort of defined picture? To enable a guided decision from a consultant phone call, because that again is another tier and another layer of decision making, which is again hindsight bias. It's really difficult to unpick these decisions. Once you've got the full picture, it's fine. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you've just been woken up out of bed to, from an on-scene registrar and flight paramedic. So that, I guess that's the next level of kind of decision-making and hindsight bias as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So Tom, just as we come into land and just finally, could I get you to speak to some of these components of a culture of excellence and just that you and the team are looking to model within and throughout London's Air Ambulance?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I'll try my best. So I think I'll focus on a couple of strands. Okay, so one is about kind of values and organisational values, and the other is about kind of expertise. So our organisational values are to be compassionate, courageous, and pioneering. And different people approach values in different ways. I think of them as directions, not destinations. And I think one of the skills, if you're going to be a values-based leader or be in a values-based organization, is how do you actually use values to actually help you work out what to do? And I think one of the things you have to be good at is working at the intersection of the values that you have as a person or in your organization, choosing how to use them. So, it isn't just saying, oh, we're a courageous organization, so I'm always going to behave courageously, which is code for I'm going to say what I want, irrespective of how negatively that lands with people, how badly it impacts their ability to do the job, and how badly it disturbs team dynamics. No, that's not what courageous means. We have to balance that with being compassionate. We have to work intelligently to sort of say, well, we've got these values, and that I've given you R3, different organizations have, for very good reasons, different values. How do we navigate that? There's this kind of virtual space, if you can imagine, between those things. We want to be really pioneering. I want to push things forward. I want the service to be doing more for patients next year than we are this year. But I have to look after my colleagues. We have to, people, this has to be a sustainable and sustaining career for people. And so there's a balance to be struck there between always pushing forward and actually just circling back and making sure we're looking after people. So I think that's one strand, being values-based and being really smartly values-based, really thinking about it, navigating it carefully, not just being like, we've written six things on the wall and we will just do those six things, or I'm going to pick the one I like and I'm doing that. I think the other strand, I said expertise. So expertise, and I think this idea of what sometimes is called ground truth. So this idea of being willing to work really hard to work out what's actually going on. So whether that's with a patient's physiology and being, and I've got a couple of colleagues who are really unpicking some of the nitty gritty of hemorrhagic shock and how that impacts on the cardiovascular system and on coronary perfusion and, the sort of transition from hemorrhagic shock into cardiogenic shock and all of these things, and not being willing to kind of take a textbook answer and go, oh, A leads to B and therefore C. And that sense that there's so much complexity out there. There is so much to know. People who are genuinely experts in their field, the amount they know, the depth of knowledge that is, available to human beings today is just astonishing. So that sense of respect for expertise and seeking sort of ground truth. And I think that goes with the that's not just patient physiology, that's, operations, that's, team dynamics, that's, really trying to work out, have we got, absolute best understanding of when to, for example, when to deploy the aircraft, when to deploy the car. You'll remember the car footprint from, you know, from your days dispatching the team? When do we think it's quicker to use the car versus the aircraft? And that was a, you know, a great thing. And we've redone that recently with really detailed granular data, looking at median aircraft and car response times for every single A to Z grid square in London, and really, you know, worked out when is it quicker. Like, we need to know this. This is important to patients. It's important that we use the right transport platform when we need to. And let's not just sort of put a finger in the wind and draw a vague line around the hospital or whatever. Let's try and get as deep into this as we can. So I think, you know, that respect for depth of knowledge and expertise, and a respect for the knowledge that resides in our team, and investing the time and the energy in really understanding difficult problem sets, and investing the time and energy in the people who can solve them, because, you know, the future technical problems are not going to be solved, you know, in however many years' time by me or you. It will be people coming along after us. So I think those are the two strands of culture that I would choose to pull out, that I think help build a culture of excellence.
Don, listen, thanks for your time today. I really do appreciate both your insights and your understanding. And it's just fascinating to unpack this this performance mindset and indeed culture. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it's been great talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. And as I said to you at the beginning, I'm not a kind of, you know, coming back to this area of expertise, I'm not a deep knowledge expert on these topics, but I've really enjoyed thinking them through and chatting them through with you. And I think there's some really interesting stuff. Thank you for the
Indeed.
opportunity.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.